recording now. Yes. And so this is an interview with Steve Fuller by, is it Na Wang?
Yes.
Yes. And what university, say what university you're from.
Beihang University, Beijing, China.
Okay. And you're visiting at the London School of Economics,
yes.
Right? Okay. And and we're going to talk about social epistemology and this new book, the Knowledge Book. Okay, so just begin.
In my eyes, you are a productive philosopher, and your research is focusing on social epistemology. The first book is your first book is social epistemology, published 1988.
That's right.
Yes. And your new book, Knowledge, The Philosophical Quest in History, published last year.
Yeah.
It's about 27 years. And I want to know, in the new book, is any changes in your opinion about social epistemology? Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, there are some changes. I would say mostly, you might say changes in emphasis. Okay. I mean, my fundamental point is pretty much the same, namely that you really cannot have an account of knowledge, especially a normative account of knowledge, that is not social or is not empirically based. I believe that's still true. I'm still quite different from mainstream epistemology in terms of not focusing exclusively on the individual as the knower, but rather looking at the larger social context and even the larger historical context in which knowledge takes place. I think there have been some changes in emphasis. I think over the last 27 years, as you say, my position, certain positions have become much more explicit, you might say. As a result of some of the research I did on Thomas Kuhn, which happened sort of in the decade immediately after social epistemology, I came to see just how much I disagreed with that position, with the position that Kuhn, because Kuhn basically has a kind of consensus-based view of science, a view of science that's very much all scientists have to agree on the same thing in order for science to make any progress, this idea of the paradigm. I'm very much against that idea. And in that time, I've become much more explicitly supportive of Karl Popper's position, which is this kind of critical, more open view toward knowledge production. So that's one thing that in a way has changed. I still very much am a kind of constructivist with regard to knowledge. In other words, I believe that even if we're talking about something like the truth, it doesn't really make sense to talk about pursuing the truth unless we're talking about some goals. Could be very long-term goals, right? But in any case, they're kind of human-related or socially related goals. So even if we're talking about what's the best for humanity in the long term, that's still, as far as I'm concerned, a kind of social constructivism. In other words, I don't believe the truth is fully detached from us. Truth is something that we construct. The issue is just, what is the scope that we're talking about? Are we just talking about truth for now, or are we talking about truth for the indefinite future in the long term? And this is where the goals of the society become very important to talk about. I would say that one, and so all of that is still pretty much the same. I also think one thing that has changed perhaps is I have become more interested in the university as an institution where knowledge is produced and distributed. That's something that I've been developing. Again, you know, if you start with a book like, let's say, The Governance of Science, and then some of this stuff that I've been writing over the last 10 years or so, because there's been so many changes to the university, But I believe that there is something very important about the university as being a very distinctly knowledge-producing institution, namely one that produces knowledge as a public good, which is to say, knowledge for everyone in principle, at least. And, of course, there's knowledge all over the place in the world, but it's only the university where it actually takes on this fully public character, where it's knowledge for everyone. And I think that that's a very important thing to maintain, even though universities have been undergoing a lot of change in recent years throughout the world. And then finally, I guess the final thing I'd want to bring up that in a way has changed, maybe, is I've become much more explicitly concerned about the nature of the knower, understood as an agent that changes itself as it learns more about itself. In other words, what does it mean to be a human being, essentially? Because I think one of the things that's really clear is that, you know, science and technology, as our most advanced forms of knowledge, have actually transformed what it means to be a human being, what it means to know, what is the potential scope and horizon of our knowledge. And so as a result, I've become very interested in this thing called Humanity 2.0. And my most recent work has been largely about that. And this has to do with the possibility that in the future, we may be challenging a lot of the sort of fundamental assumptions, especially at a biological level, about what a human being is and what a human being can know through various kinds of technological enhancements and things of that sort, you know, cyborgs. I mean, there's a lot of things on the horizon now that in a way really transforms the field of knowledge in a very substantial way. People sometimes talk about the extended mind, you know, uploading consciousness. All of these things potentially have very major impacts, not only in terms of the knowledge we get, but also in terms of who we think we are as knowers. And I think this raises a whole host of questions, because one of the things that I imagine is that we are going to enter into a period where human beings are going to become more diverse than ever before, because there will be some people who will want to upload their consciousness and will want to become cyborgs and will want to reverse the aging process and genetic modification. There'll be all these things happening, but then there'll be other people who don't want to do this. Okay? And how do we have a kind of liberal society, you know, of the sort that classical political theory was about? How do we have that kind of society that enables everyone to, in a sense, be free and to be able to express themselves, even though the forms of human expression will become more diverse than ever before? And I think that's a real interesting and deep problem, because there's going to be a question about what makes us all human at the end if we are allowed to go off in so many different sorts of directions. And that's kind of where my thinking is at the moment. And so, in a way, that gives you a sense. Now, one of the things that I do in the knowledge book, which again, I make much more explicit than I have in the past, is that I think that the quest for knowledge and this whole idea of human enhancement and our becoming more knowledgeable and more powerful and all of this kind of stuff, what's often called transhumanism, I see it very much as kind of carrying along a kind of a certain implicit theology of the human, right? In other words, a sense in which humans think of themselves as potentially godlike in character. And this is kind of among the most controversial views that I hold, because I do think that, in a sense, we seem as a species, especially if you focus on the history of the West and the West dominance of the world in the modern period, one of the things that's really striking is the extent to which human beings, in the name of progress, in the name of the advancement of science and technology, have put the entire species and the entire planet even at greater and greater risk, in a certain sense. Okay? Environmental problems, of course, issues of war, the capacity for destruction, as well as the capacity to do great things positively. All of these things have gone together in the modern period. And I think an interesting feature is the confidence that human beings have had. That, you know, human beings, despite world wars, despite atomic bombs, despite all kinds of, you know, extinction of the species, environmental problems, human beings are fundamentally progressive. We are moving forward. We are continuing. And so, in other words, we have this enormous capacity to take risk. Okay? And so I talk about this in a lot of my recent work, and I mention it a bit in the knowledge book, as a kind of proactionary attitude. Okay? So there's a distinction in the risk, in the theory of risk, between precautionary, where precautionary is to avoid, you know, harm at all costs. So become cautious with regard to risk, to see risk as potentially a threat. Whereas I hold the opposite view, and I think this opposite view actually characterizes the human species more, and it's one where we take risks, we welcome risks as providing opportunities. We embrace risks. And we have largely been successful in the whole, not in specific instances, obviously. There's been a lot of death, a lot of destruction, but in the whole, we have been successful. And I think this is very much a mark of our species. You know, can this carry on forever? I don't know. But I think in a sense, I take a very positive attitude toward all of that. And that's something also that has become much more explicit, I would say, in my more recent work.
Okay. I think your several ideas is very remarkable. Because, for example, epistemology is also social epistemology, and epistemology is a branch of philosophy.
Yes.
It is a style of doing metaphysics.
That's right.
Yes, I think it's very remarkable. Remarkable. So I want to know how can I understand the ideas?
Yeah. Well, basically, I see us, the nature of humans, I would say, is that we are world creators. So in a sense, epistemology, you might say, is looking at metaphysics from the standpoint of the agent, right? From the standpoint of the doer, the person who creates the reality. Not from the standpoint of someone who observes it, but someone who actually creates it, okay? And so this is where, I mean, I think epistemology always ends up being a kind of constructivist project if it's epistemology. So if you think about Kant, for example, you know, you think about even the positivists, the logical positivists, all of these people, in their different ways, had a kind of constructivist approach to knowledge. Knowledge is in some sense constructed, it's built, it's projected, it's made. And I have that kind of view too. And I think that in a sense, you can do an entire metaphysics this way. Entire metaphysics becomes generated from the agent. And I think, you know, you might say, where does one get this attitude toward epistemology? I think it comes from imagining the human being in the position of God, God understood as the creator, right? God creates the world. Well, we're doing something like that too. And knowledge, as it were, is our version of that, right? So, you know, so in a sense, we are trying to reproduce what God does in the course of knowing. And I don't think, see, to be honest, I don't think that is so strange, actually. If you think about the way in which we have so radically transformed the world by just being here, okay? I never quite understand when people are talking about looking for reality as it really is, independently of the human being, and this kind of other idea, right, which I talk about as object-oriented, right, an object-oriented metaphysics or epistemology, right, where in a sense you're starting from the position of the stuff just being there. I have a hard time actually coming to grips with that idea. I mean, I tend to sort of see everything from the standpoint of the creative agent, who at the end of the day is responsible for the creation, okay? So from that standpoint, right, This is why I say you can't really talk about truth by itself. You always have to talk about truth in relation to some kind of goal, some kind of value that you're trying to realize in the world. And then you could start to talk about better and worse ways of doing it, right? Whether you're getting there or not getting there. And all of the discourse of progress is about this too, right? When one can't really talk about progress unless one has already kind of set a goal and then you're saying, I'm getting there, right? Or not getting there. And these are all, who gives us these goals? We do, right? We are the ones who produce the goals. And the question then becomes, how do you define the we? Is it just one person? Is it some authoritative figure who tells everybody? Or is it a more democratic process? You see, that's the interesting question from the standpoint of social epistemology, is how do you constitute the we, who then is the agent that then constructs the reality? This is kind of the way I look at it. And so there's a lot to be unpacked about what the we is, what the we means. Who are these we?
In your books, you divide knowing and from knowledge.
Yeah, yeah.
So can I understand your social epistemology is about knowledge, not knowing?
Well,
because I think in your books, you say knowing is a personal
if you're talking about it that way, yes. I mean, see, what I'm trying to emphasize here is that that when we talk about knowledge, we're talking about something that is publicly available. It's got to be out there, right? Now, obviously, it has to be constructed and created, but the thing that makes it knowledge is its kind of public visibility, its availability, its accountability, right? So it's got to be out there. And so that's why I have, you know, generally stressed what you might call knowledge products, right? Books and things like that as the stuff of knowledge. Knowledge is not stuff happening in the head. No, knowledge is out there. Yeah. But that stuff has to be constructed. That stuff doesn't happen by itself. Yeah. In a sense, I mean, here's another way to think about it. The kind of constructivist that I am about knowledge is not so different from what one might call a kind of behavioral approach to knowledge, right? Where in a sense, how do you know someone knows something? You know, it's kind of what they're doing, which is observable, right? Which other people can hold into account. You know, I mean, so it's kind of like that. It's externalized, right?
Yeah. And there's an article written by Alvin Goldman.
Yeah.
Why social epistemology is a real epistemology.
Mm-hmm.
In this article, he divided three conceptions of social epistemology. A revisionist and preservationist and explanation. But he exclude your social epistemology from the social epistemology.
Yeah, I don't know why.
So I want to know.
I think, Alvin
Goldman. What do you think?
Alvin Goldman and I think about.
It's a book, Social Epistemology, edited by. Sorry.
Yeah, I know.
This is the first article.
I know. I mean, I think the thing that's clear is that Goldman and I have radically different views of social epistemology. He basically is an analytic epistemologist who thinks that in order to solve the sort of problems analytic epistemologists want to solve, you need to, at least in some cases, bring in some social factors. But his notion of epistemology is a fairly traditional notion, and so social epistemology is just a branch of that. So, my view of our social epistemology is different in that I actually believe that it kind of revises the whole conception of epistemology, and maybe even a philosophy more generally. Because I think this business about our knowing is very fundamental to what we are about human beings. It isn't just something else that we do. It's very fundamental to the kind of being that we are. And this is why I put a much greater stress than Goldman does on the role of science and technology, actually. I mean, most of Goldman's discussions are usually about, I mean, sometimes he talks about expertise, but a lot of times he's talking about ordinary things, okay, just like traditional epistemologists do. But I'm primarily talking about more advanced forms of knowledge, which actually have an effect in kind of transforming the human condition in a serious way. So I think Goldman and I are really operating from two really different starting points.
Yes, in your books, I think I read you say Goldman's social Goldman's epistemology is analytic. Yes, epistemology. So I want to know how do you comment on his social epistemology?
I think it's very narrow, actually. I think it's very narrow, and I think it takes too much for granted. I mean, here's one very substantive issue where we disagree in terms of something that we do talk about, right? If you look at the knowledge book, this knowledge book here, you'll see that there's a chapter on science and technology studies. And one of the things that I talk about in there and is that's relevant to Goldman is the role of expertise, okay? Goldman's view about social epistemology is that basically one of the things it should be doing is giving us some kind of clear sense of whose judgment should we believe, right? Who are the experts in given situations? Who should we trust in terms of what to believe about certain things? I mean, so there's this entire, within analytic social epistemology, there's a lot of discussion, not just Goldman, but a lot of these other people too, who write in this vein, about trust, testimony, witnessing, and expertise, all these things, and they all go together. And their view, you know, and the view that these people tend to take is, well, you should trust this person or that person, and that there's assumption that definitely that somehow trust and expertise is good. That in some sense the issue is just to find out who are the people you should trust, but that it's a good thing. I take the opposite view on this. I generally think that expertise is, in a way, as we say in English, a hostage to fortune. In other words, sometimes we do have to trust other people. We have to trust their judgments about things, but that's always entering into a certain amount of risk. Okay, the trust involves risk. Namely, you're letting someone else decide something for you. You're not doing it yourself. You're letting someone else do it. And of course, that may sometimes be justified, but in any case, you're always putting yourself at risk by trusting the other person rather than taking the responsibility yourself. And I think that one of the things that makes us progress as knowers is to be able to take more of the risks ourselves. In other words, to be able to decide things more for ourselves, not to rely on experts. Okay? And here I would say my view is very much informed by the Enlightenment, by the 18th century Enlightenment. If you know, one of the things that the 18th century Enlightenment was about that people should no longer have to trust the church or the king, right, but should be able to think through things themselves, use their own reason, use their own powers of judgment. If you recall, Kant says in his famous essay, "What is Enlightenment?" Dare to know. Okay? That's always been very much part of my social epistemology, and it's a fundamentally anti-expert approach. Okay? So I'm very much of the view that whenever there is some kind of concentrated expertise somewhere, like somebody who does a lot of training and it's very difficult to know something unless you've worked on it for a long time, that efforts should be made to simplify, to make it more accessible, to make it more available. And you see, this is why I think the university is so important, because the university doesn't just do research into more advanced things, it does that, but it also teaches. And it's the teaching function which is the way by which you can start to break down expertise, because knowledge that starts off by just being in the hands of a few people, the experts, get to be in the hands of everyone as they are taught in classrooms and so forth. And it seems to me that's how we make progress. We make progress basically by deconstructing expertise, not by following expertise, but by deconstructing expertise. And I would say that's one very substantive area where Goldman and I are very much in disagreement. That area might even be the most important one from the standpoint of a substantive first order question about knowledge, where we really disagree. In fact, I probably disagree with most of the analytic social epistemologists on this point.
Okay. In your book, Sociology of Intellectual Living. Mm-hmm. This book is the first book I read. So we must win back the critical advantage of university.
That's right.
Yes. This idea is very exciting, I think. What can I do in practice?
Okay.
What do you do in practice?
Well, I think. Well, here's the thing. Keep in mind there's a kind of ideal notion of the university which I defend, and it is this ideal that's associated with Humboldt in the German tradition. And the idea is that research and teaching are integral to each other, that is a unity of teaching and research. And it is related to what we were just talking about, in the sense that research tends to create new forms of expertise, new forms of intellectual advantage. Now, if a university is just focused exclusively on research, what you're going to end up is having a kind of manufactured elitism, frankly. Okay, you'll have a few people who know a lot of stuff because they're working on it all the time. And especially as knowledge becomes more specialized, okay, that's a real danger. Okay, so what you need to complement that is you need teaching. In other words, the people who are doing the advanced research, right, should not just be talking to other advanced researchers, but should be talking to students, most of whom will not know much about the background, most of whom will not want to become researchers themselves. They'll do other things with their lives. But nevertheless, what you're trying to do in the classroom is to say, what is it that I have been working on that is actually relevant to your life? In other words, beyond the level of expertise and all of the fact that the knowledge is new, what is it actually relevant for your life? So you're trying to integrate your research into the lives of these people through teaching. This is the key thing, it seems to me. And I think the problem that we face in universities today, at least in most of the world that I'm aware of, is that the teaching and the research functions are being disentangled, disaggregated. So you got a group of people who do research, and they just do research, and they're often paid well for doing it as well. And then you have a different group of people doing teaching. And they're sort of different, okay? And that destroys the university, it seems to me. And in particular, it destroys the ability of the university to actually enlighten the general population. Because the enlightenment function of the university actually happens in the classroom. It doesn't happen in the research arena, but it happens in the classroom. In the research arena, you just have researchers talking to each other. And it's a very elite activity. Okay, so this is kind of, and the university is really the only place that at least institutionally confronts the issue, namely that you have to take this very elite expert knowledge and somehow translate it so that it is available for the large majority of people. I mean, at least this is, certainly this is what I do in my own practice, okay? I'm someone who does a lot of research, but does a lot of teaching too. I do both.
But in China, the condition is in university, research is important, is more important,
yeah.
And the teach is
This is true.
Yes.
I would say this is true here too.
Yes, because university evaluated teachers, the professors, by using research indicators.
Yes.
So,
it's same here. It's the same here, actually.
Yes. When I came to LSE, I found it's the same here.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, there are incentives for people to get grants, so they don't have to do teaching and they can just do research all the time.
No, I teach and do research.
Yeah. Yes. But in this country, a lot of people get grants so they don't have to do teaching.
Yes.
Yes, it happens. I mean, so and in fact, this is.
But they are called professor.
Some are, but even younger people are encouraged.
Because in China, if you only research, do not teaching, you can be called researcher, not professor.
No, I understand, but no, it's possible to be, as it were, purely a research professor in this country. Yes.
I have a student. It's a master candidate. His master thesis. It's about knowing subject.
Uh-huh.
So he have read your books.
Okay.
He have some questions. Want to ask you.
Okay.
So and the first one is, what's the origin of thought that you critical the big science?
What?
It's from a critical tradition, or from your own appearance and feeling to big science.
I'm not. Let me see if I understand that.
She want to know what's the origin.
Where does my criticism of big science come from?
Yes. Yes. I think so. Yes.
I think the problem with big science is basically that it's a kind of, let's put it this way. If you want science to progress, you want to be able to pursue many different lines of research, okay? Now, that means that you cannot have all of your resources concentrated in just one or two big projects, okay? And this is a point that I made, I guess, in the Governance of Science book.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
If you define, because I think there is a tendency, certainly after World War II, for the most prestigious forms of scientific research to be the big science stuff. So whether we're talking about the Human Genome Project or all of the nuclear research, all the stuff having to do with the particle accelerators. And now, as you know, there are all these big initiatives for mapping the brain that billions of dollars, both in Europe and in the United States. And these are very high profile kind of projects. But one of the consequences of them is that they often end up then absorbing all the resources for science and a lot of other projects that might actually be quite interesting and have some very important benefits end up, there's no resources for them. Everybody just gets focused, and all the training for new scientists end up going in particular directions, right? So there's a sense in which, to put it, economic terms, big science creates kind of path dependencies, right? In other words, because you've put so much money into something, then all of your incentives are going to be to keep on pursuing it, because you've invested so much money in it. And so as a result, you end up ignoring other lines of research. You see what I mean? So it's that kind of problem. It's a problem of resource concentration. Okay? And so what that means then, and that raises another problem, right? Which is that when you have invested so much money in a big science project, it is very difficult actually to criticize it in any fundamental way, right? So in other words, you might make criticisms of particular, you know, theories or observations or whatever, but if you've already spent billions of pounds or dollars doing something, then it's going to be very difficult to be able to just criticize the whole thing because so much money has already been spent on it. You're sort of stuck with it, okay? And I think that's in the so there's a sense in which just the sheer size of the resource commitment ends up forcing you to be less critical about the outputs because you've invested so much in it. And I think that's kind of the main basis for my criticism, actually.
Second question is, do you think that different individual factors of the researchers, like education background and living in environment, will affect their favor to liberalize and communication or republication in your book, Governments of?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a general point here about the way science operates. Okay, there are two kind of issues. If you're just looking at what promotes scientific knowledge generally, then I think most scientists are quite open and willing to publish and, you know, and are quite happy to kind of exchange information with other scientists and things like that. I think that's quite normal. And I don't think you go into science unless you already are like that, right? You can't just do science by yourself in this respect. In a sense, you have to always be wanting to publicize your results, learn from others. There has to be a constant exchange taking place. But then there are other issues going on, okay? And some of them have to do with the uses to which this knowledge get put, right? So, for example, science is very important for national development. Okay, that can end up restricting the kind of communication that one makes in science, okay? There are also various kinds of, what should we say? Because science costs money, there's also going to be competition for resources among the scientists, because the communication side of science is great if everybody's got enough money to do research. But if some people are better off than others, then there will be more strategic kind of, you know, communication taking place, right, in order to gain advantage. So as soon as you bring in political and economic factors, that ends up changing the pattern of communication, sometimes quite substantially. And, you know, at least in the West, we have all these intellectual property issues that start to come up, okay? You know, where people, you know, where we're depending on who's paying for the science, right? The payer can own it, essentially. Especially so if we're talking about, you know, corporate science, business-oriented science, that kind of thing can happen. And, you know, generally speaking in the West, the state has been investing less money in science, expecting that the private sector will pick up the cost. But if the private sector picks up the cost, then you're also more likely to get these kind of proprietary constraints placed on the science. You see, so you've got all of these kinds of issues at play that I think end up influencing the degree of communication. And there's also one more factor, which you mentioned briefly in one of your comments, about the role of the research indicators. So, you know, all of this communication is taking place, but then the way that is understood, right, ends up then getting used to evaluate the scientists. So let's say, you know, I'm publishing all these papers and I'm reading all these papers of other people and I'm citing some people, but I'm not citing other people, right? that might just be part of normal communication, but it ends up having impact on how you evaluate the researchers involved. Okay, so there's that going on too. So all of these things are sort of happening as part of the communication process in science, which in a way ends up making it very difficult to talk about it as being completely free.
What do you think women's cognitive way is particular to doing science? Women's...
Well, that's interesting, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of views about that, actually. I mean, when I was a student, which was probably during the period when feminism had the biggest impact, I would say, in the study of science, there was this very important kind of feminist critic of science by the name of Evelyn Fox Keller. I don't know if you've heard of her, who actually did kind of argue that there was this kind of very particular women's way of more intuitive, getting inside of the thing being studied, all of this kind of stuff. And this was very much, and there was this view that if more women went into science, it would actually change the style of science, because women kind of knew the world differently, you might say, than men. Now, I guess my view about this is a little mixed in that I actually do think there are different ways of knowing the world. And I actually do think that what Fox Keller is talking about actually does correspond to something, but I'm not sure it's gender specific. Okay? So in other words, what Fox Keller is identifying as a kind of women's way of doing science is also largely the kind of way of doing science that you can find in someone like Michael Polanyi. If you're familiar with Michael Polanyi, personal knowledge, right? It's very similar kind of approach to science. Very much against the same sorts of things, but not, talking quite openly about the need to, in some sense, merge between the subject and the object so that you kind of think the world through the standpoint of the organism or whatever you're studying. That's in Polanyi. And that's a very recognizable kind of tradition of knowing. But it isn't exclusively feminine, you see? In other words, some men have it too. And then on the other side, of course, if you look at the women who have succeeded in science, in terms of how they've succeeded, very often it's been by doing the same kind of science the men have been doing, okay? And there's not really any clear difference. Okay, so the point here is, I would say that there are different ways of knowing the world, different ways of doing science, but I am not so convinced that they are gender marked. Okay, they're there, but men and women can be either one. Okay, that's kind of my view. There's a kind of sociological question, you might say, about will the character of science in some way shift by having more women in science, okay? Because more and more women are going into science, and so then there's a question about, does this shift the character of the science? I'm not sure that it does. But I do think, you know, there are certain things where I think the introduction of women does cause some changes. So there are some changes. I don't know how substantial they are, but they're there. I think, for example, some of the kind of, there's all this, what gets called the kind of macho culture of science, a kind of, which has to do with a lot of the characteristics of men when they're together very much become part of science because science is mostly men. I think some of that gets broken down when you have more women, okay? And I think maybe and I'm not sure about this, but there's maybe in the long term, because women have a kind of different life cycle from men in terms of the issue of children. See, the thing about science, the from a sociological standpoint, the most straightforward way of succeeding in science is basically to be doing it all the time, right? In other words, if you're a scientist, you spend your whole life doing science, right? And of course, this is easier for men to do because men don't have such serious child-raising functions. And there is a whole, already a culture of, you know, that accepts the idea that men are working all the time. Whereas with women, it's a different matter. Women have a home, women have children, right? I mean, and the thing is that if you, you know, if you bring more women into science and these women have some of the traditional features of women, you know, home life and children and things like this, it seems to me that this does then kind of will force the scientific community to change the career expectations of what a scientist ought to be doing. Right? So in other words, one shouldn't expect the scientist to be in the laboratory 24 hours a day. Right? That scientists should have a home. That scientists should be able to raise children. Right? I mean, I think that might be a consequence of bringing more women into science, might be to kind of make science more life-friendly, more friendly to the other aspects of life than it currently is. Okay? Now, does that... those are important things, right? Those are important things, but I'm not sure if they actually change the cognitive issue of science, how you do science when you are doing science. You see, I think that might be a somewhat... That's where I go back to Polanyi and people like that. Then, in a sense, I don't know if that's gender-marked. Yes, so you see what I'm saying? It's kind of a mixed picture.
Next. In your opinion, what kind of people or researchers does the republication seem aiming to cultivate?
What kind of image of researchers?
That's the republication.
Oh, the republicanism.
Yes.
This my view.
Yes.
Okay.
In your book.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So yes. So let me just explain this a little bit. So the idea here is that one of the problems that science currently has, and this is where, so I'm a believer in what I call sort of republican, a kind of republican approach to science. And what makes republicanism quite distinctive as a form of political democracy is that it operates on a principle of equal citizenship, right? So the only sort of people who can be members of a republic are people who can be treated as equals, who everyone treats as an equal, right? So it has this kind of fundamental equality built into it. Now, one of the problems that science has at the moment, which is why it's not republican, is that actually not all scientists are treated equally, okay? So this is kind of the main problem, right? And so... You know, if we're talking about something like the research indicators and so forth, it's quite clear that lots of science is being done, but most of it is not being read, and even less of it is being cited, right, or referenced in the work of other scientists. So you end up having a system where science is supposedly a kind of republic of peers. We talk about peer review and all this in science all the time. And supposedly, a peer means equal. And that supposedly science is this kind of society or republic of equals. But as a matter of fact, relatively few people get most of the attention, most of the rewards, and most of the power. So there's a complete asymmetry in the way in which the scientific community is organized. You see, you've got all these people publishing all these things, but relatively little of it is read or cited. So you don't have a republic in place, okay? What you might have is something like a kind of liberal market, right? You might have a market for in a sense because there's people, as it were, are making judgments about who is the best researcher, who should they be reading, and who do they read? They read what everybody else reads. And so you get these kind of kind of market crowd effects, right? Where people gravitate toward the leaders, right? And then everybody else just gets forgotten. Okay? And that's a kind of market phenomenon. And I talk about that in terms of a kind of liberalism in science. But that's not the republic of science that I'm talking about, which would actually treat each scientist equally, right? And make each, you know, and how would you enforce this republic of science? Well, actually, we should be thinking in terms of potential areas in which the scientific community is actually allowed to vote on scientific matters, with each person counting as one. Okay, in terms of theories, perhaps in terms of research proposals, research programs, things of that type, that where you there should actually be a kind of one person, one vote kind of approach to everyone who has been formally recognized as a scientist. So let's say everybody who's got a PhD or everybody who has a scientific position, right? They are a citizen of science. They should each count. You see, this is what I'm talking about. Science isn't organized this way at the moment. In a sense, you can get a PhD in science, you can hold a scientific position, but you could be completely ignored by the rest of the scientific community. Right? I mean, and so this is very strange. It's very strange. In a sense, and it's especially strange because I think the self-understanding of science is that somehow among scientists, there is an equality, but it doesn't really exist. But nevertheless, that's kind of constantly what you're being told.
The last one is some scholars think that your open society,
yeah,
that laymen can check and evaluate scientific thought is utopia. Because people could not know about all of scientific knowledge. Even the education level has reached the highest level. And so I want to know, how do you like this view? What do you think? And your reply?
Well, okay, look. It's utopian in one sense, namely that I see it as kind of an ideal to strive for, okay? Because my view here is, my basic view is we're always talking about science as universal knowledge, right? That it's true for all things, for all people. Well, if that's true, then all people should be able to understand it. I mean, it seems to me that, what's at stake here is the universalization of science. You cannot have something that is, true for all people and most people don't understand it. That's the basic point. So in a sense, we should be aiming for everyone to understand it. And this is one of the reasons why I'm a big believer in the idea that expertise can be overcome, that there are simpler ways, there are straightforward ways of putting things. Okay, it is possible to train people. I also think, we've got technology. We've got lots of different ways of educating people, right? There's lots of ways of conveying knowledge, okay? There's lots of ways in which theories and ideas can be expressed, and they don't have to just all be in writing, okay? I mean, in other words, one can be creative about this, okay? But nevertheless, it should be possible to get mass participation. I mean, one thing... I don't know if you know. I talk about this sometimes in some of my works. One of the major logical positivists was this guy Otto Neurath, Neurath, Neurath. Yeah. Let me read. Neu. You mentioned Nancy Cartwright when you first contacted me. She has a book on him, right? Now this guy, who was a sociologist, right, by training, he came up in after World War I, he came up with this, what he thought would be a kind of universal scientific language. Now, the logical positivists were very much into kind of having a universal scientific language. Neurath thought about this not simply in terms of logic, let's say, but in terms of what he called isotypes, I-S-O-T-Y-P-E. And these were basically symbols, pictorial symbols, right, that could stand for complex ideas. So, you know, we see these things all the time, right? You know, like the symbol for male and female in the toilets, all this kind of stuff, right? In other words, but you could also have this not just for those things, but also for complex things like representing economic indicators. So if you see the bar graphs, you know, and some of the pictograms, you know, where in a sense you can just look at a chart that has lots of pictures and you can get a lot of information out of it very quickly, right? Whereas if you were to explain it all in technical language, it could take forever. But you could see a picture and you get a clear sense of, let's say, how the economy is doing or something like that. Well, he came up with this idea, and his basic argument was that this would be kind of the best vehicle for democratizing knowledge, right? So that people could immediately know all of the knowledge that the bureaucrats and the technocrats knew about the society, right? That the ordinary people could know it. So what he argued was, and he got this instituted in Vienna in the 1920s, that you could have like placards, you know, in the city parks, which had the major economic statistics in a kind of pictorial form. And so people could just look at this stuff and get a sense of where the economy is doing well, where it's doing poorly, and then you would be able to have kind of immediately informed discussions about this without anyone having to take economics courses or studying advanced mathematics or anything of that sort, okay? And his view was you could probably do this for everything if you get clever enough sort of design people involved to get the pictures right so that people can immediately make the right associations. Okay, now this was happening, I think it's worth pointing out that his idea, he was coming up with these ideas during the period that we normally see as the golden age of advertising. Okay, so, because with advertising, again, it's the issue of getting the picture to give, you know, say 1,000 words, right? That in a sense, by looking at the thing, you immediately are making certain associations that then all of a sudden inform you of various things. Okay, well, so this was his idea, and it was a kind of thing that was very widely discussed in the interwar period between World War I and World War II, you know, I think this is kind of an idea that ought to be looked at again, especially given our abilities now, you know, with the kind of computer-aided design possibilities of being able to come up with much more sophisticated kind of pictorial visual representations, you know, of lots of complex streams of data, right? I mean, you may know that you know, we've now got this big data stuff going on, right? Well, part of the study of big data has to do with trying to come up with very kind of easy, straightforward ways of reading the data, right? Of seeing the patterns, of being able to pick up stuff intuitively, right? And it seems to me that this is where we should be moving, right? So in other words, this is how you get to a point where even ordinary people would be able to assess complex forms of information, make, you know, complex judgments and so forth. You just have to find the right vehicles that they can relate to. And one of the problems with expertise is that expert knowledge is typically coded in language that is very alien to people. It does not take advantage of things people already know. It's like you have to learn a totally new language. Whereas what Neurath was talking about was basically capitalizing on the way in which people already respond to images, right? And so this is where I think, you know, we should be going with this.
I have read an article in Disunity of Science.
Yeah.
It is by you.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
I remember.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And so this is why I think there are steps that can be taken, right? Of course, it's an ideal thing, but we could be moving in that direction, right? The idea is to actually move in that direction. And I actually don't see that much movement at the moment. That's the problem. I think there's a tendency to take expertise for granted, that it's, you know, you just got to have experts, right? That certain things are just too difficult for ordinary people to understand, right? I think this is just taken for granted too much.
Thank you.
Okay, is that it?
Thank you.
Yes, okay.